hospitalizations, and missed school days for children. It's considered a controllable but incurable disease. Asthma is an immune system sensitivity that provokes constriction and spasms in the airways. Pollutants, dust, cold air, and more can all lead to attacks. But asthma can also be brought on by overbreathing, which is why it's so common during physical exertion, a condition called exercise-induced asthma that affects around 15% of the population and up to 40% of athletes. At rest or during exercise, asthmatics as a whole tend to breathe more, sometimes much more than those without it. Once an attack starts, things go from bad to worse. Air gets trapped in the lungs, which makes it harder to push breath in and out. More breathing, but more constriction, more panic, and more stress. The worldwide market for asthma therapies is $20 billion, and drugs often work so well that they can feel like a virtual cure. But drugs can have horrendous side effects after several years, including deteriorating lung function, more asthma symptoms, blindness, and increased risk of death. Millions of asthma sufferers already know this, and they are experiencing these problems for themselves. Many of them have trained themselves to breathe less and reported dramatic improvement. For several months before the Stanford experiment, I interviewed Buteyko practitioners and collected their stories. One was David Weeb, a luthier of cellos and violins from Woodstock, New York. I'd read about him in the New York Times. Weeb had suffered from severe asthma since he was 10. He used bronchodilators up to 20 times a day, along with steroids in an effort to keep the symptoms at bay. His body became tolerant of the drugs, which meant that Weeb had to increase his dose. After decades of constant use, the steroids weakened his eyesight. If he kept taking them, Weeb would go blind. If he stopped taking them, he wouldn't be able to breathe and might die of an asthma attack. Within 3 months of learning how to breathe less, Weeb was using no more than one inhaler puff a day, and he'd cut out steroids entirely. He claimed to feel few asthma symptoms at all. For the first time in 5 decades, he was breathing easy. Even Weeb's pulmonologist was impressed, confirming that there was a marked improvement. There were others beside him, like the chief information officer at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who had suffered from the same debilitating asthma his whole life and who, like Weeb, reported few symptoms within weeks of breathing less. "I'm a new man," he wrote. Then there was a 70-year-old woman I'd spent an hour with at a Whole Foods cafe. She'd experienced crippling asthma for the past 6 decades and could hardly walk a block without having an attack. After a few months of breathing less, she was hiking mountains and on her way to travel to Mexico. "This is nothing short of a miracle," she told me. There was a mom from Kentucky who endured such horrendous breathing problems that she contemplated suicide. Then there were athletes like Olympians Ramon Anderson, Matthew Dunn, and Sanya Richards Ross, who all used breathing less methods. They claimed to have gained a boost in performance and blunted the symptoms of respiratory problems simply by decreasing the volume of air in their lungs. The most convincing scientific validation of breathing less that I could find came by way of Dr. Alicia Murette, director of the Anxiety and Depression Research Center at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. In 2014, Murette and a team of researchers gathered more than 100 asthma sufferers, measured their lung functions and blood gases, then gave them a handheld capnometer, which tracked the carbon dioxide in their exhaled breath. Over 4 weeks, the asthmatics would carry the device around and practice breathing less to keep their CO2 levels at a healthy level of around 5.5%. If the levels dipped, the patients would breathe less until the CO2 rose back up. A month later, 80% of the asthmatics had raised their carbon dioxide and experienced significantly fewer asthma attacks. They also experienced better lung function and a widening of their airways. They breathed better. The symptoms of their asthma were markedly decreased. "When people hyperventilate, there's something very strange happening," Murette wrote. "In essence, they are taking in too much air, but the sensation that they get is shortness of breath, choking, air hunger, as if they're not getting enough air. It's almost like a biological system error. Willing the body to breathe less appeared to correct that error. By the end of his career and the end of his life in 2003 at the age of 80, Buteyko would become a bit of a mystic. He barely slept and claimed that his techniques could not only heal illness but promote intuition and other forms of extrasensory perception. He was convinced that heart problems, hemorrhoids, gout, cancer, and more than 100 other diseases were all caused by CO2 deficiency, brought on by overbreathing. He even considered asthma attacks less a problem and more a compensatory action. The airway closing, the wheezing, the shortness of breath was the body's natural reflex to breathe less and more slowly. For these reasons and others, Buteyko and his methods have been largely dismissed by today's medical community. Nonetheless, a few dozen researchers over the past decades have attempted to gain some kind of real scientific validation on the restorative effects of breathing less. One study at the Mater Hospital in Brisbane, Australia, found that when asthmatic adults decreased their air intake by a third, symptoms of breathlessness reduced by 70% and the need for reliever medication decreased by around 90%. A half dozen other clinical trials showed the same results. Meanwhile, the Papworth method, a breathing less technique developed in an English hospital in the 60s, was shown to cut asthma symptoms by a third. But still, nobody seems to know exactly why breathing less has been so effective in treating asthma and other respiratory conditions. Nobody knows exactly how it works. There are several theories. It is a deficiency in the body that causes symptoms, said Dr. Ira Packman, an internist and former medical expert for the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. Years ago, Packman overcame his own debilitating asthma by breathing less. Replace the deficient element, Packman told me, and the patient gets better. Packman explained that overbreathing can have other deeper effects on the body beyond just lung function and constricted airways. When we breathe too much, we expel too much CO2, and our blood pH rises to become more alkaline. When we breathe slower and hold in more CO2, pH lowers, and blood becomes more acidic. Almost all cellular functions in the body take place at a blood pH of 7.4, our sweet spot between alkaline and acid. When we stray from that, the body will do whatever it can to get us back there. The kidneys, for instance, will respond to overbreathing by buffering, a process in which an alkaline compound called bicarbonate is released into the urine. With less bicarbonate in the blood, the pH lowers back to normal, even if we continue to huff and puff. It's as if nothing ever happened. The problem with buffering is that it's meant as a temporary fix. Weeks, months, or years of overbreathing, and this buffering will deplete the body of essential minerals. This occurs because as bicarbonate leaves us, it takes magnesium, phosphorus, and more with it. Without healthy stores of these minerals, nothing works right. Nerves malfunction, smooth muscles spasm, and cells can't efficiently create energy. Breathing becomes even more difficult. This is one reason why asthmatics and other people with chronic respiratory problems are prescribed supplements like magnesium to stave off further attacks. Constant buffering also weakens the bones, which try to compensate by dissolving their own mineral stores back into the bloodstream. Yes, it's possible to overbreathe yourself into osteoporosis and increased risk of bone fractures. This unending grind of imbalances and compensations, of deficiencies and strain, will eventually break the body down. Packman was quick to point out that not all respiratory illness sufferers and other sick people have a carbon dioxide deficiency problem. Those with emphysema, for instance, may have dangerously high levels of CO2 because they've got too much stale air trapped inside. Others may test with completely normal blood gas and pH levels. But such nitpicking, he told me, missed the larger point. All these people have a breathing problem. They're stressed, they're inflamed, they're congested, and they struggle to get air in and out of their lungs. And it's these breathing problems that slow-paced, less techniques are so effective at fixing. Over several months, I visited with several Buteyko teachers and other slow-breathing devotees. They all told me the same story of how they'd been plagued by some chronic respiratory illness that no drug or surgery or anything else could fix, how they all cured themselves with nothing more than breathing less. The techniques they use varied, but all circled around the same premise, to extend the length of time between inhalations and exhalations. The less one breathes, the more one absorbs the warming touch of respiratory efficiency, and the further the body can go. This shouldn't come as much of a surprise. Nature functions in orders of magnitude. Mammals with the lowest resting heart rates live the longest, and it's no coincidence that these are consistently the same mammals that breathe the slowest. The only way to retain a slow resting heart rate is with slow breaths. This is as true for baboons and bison as it is for blue whales and us. The yogi's life is not measured by the number of his days, but the number of his breaths, wrote B.K.S. Iyengar, an Indian yoga teacher who had spent years in bed as a sickly child until he breathed himself back to health. He died in 2014 at the age of 95. I'd hear this repeated over and over again by Olson during our Skype chats and again throughout the Stanford experiment. I'd read about it in Stow's research. Buteyko and the Catholics, the Buddhists, the Hindus, and the 9/11 survivors were onto it as well. By various means, in various ways, in various eras of human history, all these pulmonauts discovered the same thing. They learned that the optimum amount of air we should take in at rest per minute is 5.5 liters. The optimum breathing rate is about 5.5 breaths per minute. That's 5.5 inhales and 5.5 exhales. This is the perfect breath. Asthmatics, emphysemics, Olympians, and almost anyone else anywhere can benefit from breathing this way for only a few minutes a day, but much longer if possible. To inhale and exhale in a way that feeds our bodies just the right amount of air at just the right time to perform at peak capacity. To just keep breathing less. Chapter 7. Chew. It's the 19th day of the Stanford experiment, and Olson and I are once again sitting side by side at the dining room table at the center of the home lab. The place is officially a sty. We've just stopped caring, because now we're just a few hours away from it all being over. I'm sitting with the same thermometer and the same nitric oxide sensor in my mouth, with the same blood pressure cuff around my bicep. Olson's got the same face mask around his head, with the same sensor on his ear. He's wearing the same slippers as well. We've done this 5 dozen times in the past 3 weeks. It would have all been unbearable had it not been for the mounting energy, mental clarity, and overall well-being we felt. Such vast and sudden improvements the minute we stopped mouth breathing. Last night, Olson snored for 3 minutes, while I clocked in about 6. A 4,000% decrease from 10 days ago. Our sleep apnea, which disappeared the first night of nasal breathing, has remained non-existent. My blood pressure this morning was 20 points lower than at its highest point at the beginning of the experiment. On average, I've dropped about 10 points. My CO2 levels consistently rose and were finally nudging towards that super endurance mark shared by Buteyko's healthiest subjects. Olson, once again, showed similar improvements. We did it all by breathing through our noses, slowly, and less with full exhales. "I'm done," declares Olson, with the same smirk on his face. He walks down the hallway one last time and goes back across the street. And one last time, I'm left alone in the clutter where I eat the same dinner I had 10 days ago. The Last Supper, a bowl of pasta, leftover spinach, and a few soggy croutons. I take a seat at the kitchen table in front of the same unread pile of Sunday papers, pour a little olive oil and salt into the bowl, and take a bite. A few mashes in my mouth, and it's gone. As random as it may seem, this mundane act, that few seconds of soft chewing, was the catalyst for writing this book. It's what inspired me to turn the casual hobby of investigating what happened to me in that Victorian room a decade ago into a full-time quest to discover the lost art and science of breathing. At the beginning of this audiobook, I began to fill in why humans have such a hard time breathing, how all that tenderizing and cooking of food eventually led to airway obstruction. But the changes that occurred in our heads and airways so many years ago were only a small part of how we got here. There is a much deeper history to our origins, which is weirder and wilder than anything I'd stumbled upon before. And so here, at the end of the Stanford experiment, it seems only appropriate to start over, to pick up where we left off, at the dawn of human civilization. 12,000 years ago, humans in Southwest Asia and the Fertile Crescent in the Eastern Mediterranean stopped hunting game and gathering wild vegetables as they had for hundreds of thousands of years. They started growing their food. These were the first farming cultures, and in these primitive communities, humans suffered from the first widespread instances of crooked teeth and deformed mouths. It wasn't terrible at first. While one farming culture was plagued by malocclusion, another, hundreds of miles away, seemed not to suffer at all. Crooked teeth and all the breathing problems that come with them seemed totally random. Then, about 300 years ago, it all went viral. Suddenly, much of the world's population began to suffer. Their mouths shrank, their faces grew flatter, and their sinuses plugged. These morphological changes to the human head that had occurred up to this point, all that lowering of the larynx that clogged our throats and the expansion of our brains that lengthened our faces, all of these were negligible compared to the sudden shift. Our ancestors adapted to them just fine. But the changes triggered by the rapid industrialization of farm foods bore a heavy cost. Within just a few generations of eating this stuff, modern humans became the worst breathers in Homo history, the worst breathers in the animal kingdom. I had a hard time comprehending this when I first came across it years back. Why hadn't I been told about it in school? Why didn't so many of those sleep doctors or dentists or pulmonologists I interviewed know this story? Because this research wasn't happening in the halls of medicine. It was happening in ancient burial sites. The anthropologist working there told me that if I wanted to really understand how such a sudden and dramatic change could occur, I needed to leave the labs and get into the field. I needed to see some of the patient zeros of the modern obstructed human, the turning point when our farm-fed faces fell apart on a mass scale. I needed to get my hands on some skulls, old ones and lots of them. I hadn't been introduced to Mariana Evans yet, so I didn't know the Morton Collection existed. I called some friends instead. One of them told me that my best chance of stumbling upon a large trove of specimens was to fly to Paris and wait beside some trash cans along Rue Bonaparte. My guides would be there on Tuesday night. "This way," the leader said. The rusting steel door behind us moaned and squealed. The sliver of streetlight grew thinner and thinner until there was no light at all, only fading echoes. One of the guides I was following lit up her headlamp while the two others cinched their backpacks, and together they led me deeper into pure blackness. The dead were downstairs. 6 million of them, spread out in a labyrinth of halls, stalls, ossuaries, black rivers, and billionaire playrooms. There was the skull of Charles Perrault, the author of Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella. A little deeper were the femurs of Antoine Lavoisier, the father of modern chemistry, and the ribs of Jean-Paul Marat, the assassinated French Revolution leader. all these skulls, all these bones, and millions of others, some dating back thousands of years, had been lying here, silently collecting dust underneath the Garden of Luxembourg in the heart of the Left Bank. Leading the expedition was a woman in her early 30s with a purple-red mane that draped over a faded camouflage jacket. She was followed by another woman in a red pantsuit and a third in a blue coat. They wore knee-high mud boots and overstuffed kit bags and looked like cast members from that all-female Ghostbusters reboot. I didn't know their real names and was told not to ask. These guides, I would learn, prefer to be anonymous. At the foot of the staircase was a tunnel made of rough limestone walls. As we pushed deeper, the walls grew a little tighter, eventually forming a hexagonal shape, narrow at the feet, wide at the shoulders, and narrow again at the top. The tunnel had been built this way for efficiency, to allow ancient miners to walk single file in as little space as possible. But the curious result was that the hallways were the shape of a coffin. Fitting, perhaps, because we just entered into one of the largest graveyards on Earth. For 1,000 years, Parisians had buried their dead at the center of the city, mostly in a plot of land that became known as Holy Innocents Cemetery. After centuries of use, Holy Innocents became overcrowded, and the dead were stacked in warehouses, one on top of another. These warehouses became overcrowded, too, until the walls collapsed and spilled decomposing bodies all over the city streets. With nowhere to put the dead, Parisian authorities instructed miners to dump them into wagons and wheel them into Paris's quarries. As new limestone quarries were dug out to build the Arc de Triomphe, the Louvre, and other great buildings, more bodies went underground. By the turn of the 20th century, there were more than 170 miles of quarry tunnels filled with millions and millions of skeletons. The city of Paris offered a sanctioned tour of the quarries called the Paris Catacombs, but that only covered a small portion. I'd come here to look inside the other 99%, where there are no tourists, descriptive plaques, ropes, lights, or rules, where nothing was off limits. A group called Cataphiles has been exploring the nether regions of this space for more than 60 years. They found their way down through storm drains, manholes, and secret doorways along Rue Bonaparte. Some cataphiles had built private clubhouses. Others hosted weekly subterranean clubs. There was a rumor that a French billionaire chiseled out his own lavish apartment down there and hosted private parties doing God knows what. Cataphiles made new discoveries all the time. My guide, the woman with the red-purple hair, whom I'll call Red, had spent 15 years mapping these dirty tunnels. She was fascinated with the stories and the history of the place. She told me earlier that she discovered a new ossuary an hour's hike from here. It was filled with a few thousand victims of a cholera epidemic that ravaged Paris almost 200 years ago. This was the time in Western history when small mouths, crooked teeth, and obstructed airways became the norm throughout much of industrial Europe. These were the skulls I was looking for. We passed through halls over puddles of stagnant water and crawled face to butt like a human centipede through a kind of oversized rodent hole. Then we reached a stack of wine bottles and dented beer cans. The walls were layered in decades of graffiti. On one were the initials of two lovers, on another some cartoon dicks, on yet another the obligatory 666. A few feet in front of us was a stack of what looked like kindling. It wasn't kindling, not wood at all. It was a heap of femurs, sternums, ribs, and fibulas. Bones, all human. This was the path to the secret ossuary. By around 1500, that farming that had begun in Southwest Asia in the Fertile Crescent 10,000 years earlier took over the world. The human population grew to 500 million, 100 times what it had been at the dawn of agriculture. Life for city dwellers was miserable. Streams of human waste gushed down the streets. Air was tainted with coal smoke, and nearby rivers and lakes ran with blood, fat, hair, and acids from manufacturing. Infections, disease, and plague were a constant menace. In these societies, for the first time in history, humans could spend their entire lives eating nothing but processed food. Nothing fresh, nothing raw, nothing natural. Millions did. Advances in milling removed the germ and bran from rice, leaving only the starchy white seed. Roller mills ripped the germ and bran from wheat, leaving only a soft white flour. Meats, fruits, and vegetables were canned and bottled. All of these methods extended the shelf life of foods and made them more accessible to the public. But they also made them mushy and soft. Sugar, which had once been a prized commodity of the wealthy, became increasingly common and cheap. This new, highly processed food lacked fiber, vitamins, and other nutrients. As a result, urban populations would grow sicker and smaller. In the 1730s, before the onset of industrialization, the average Briton stood about 5'7". Within a century, the population shrank 2 inches to less than 5'5". The human face began rapidly deteriorating too. Mouths shrank and facial bones grew stunted. Dental disease became rampant, and incidence of crooked teeth and jaws increased tenfold. Our mouths got so bad, so overcrowded, that it became common to have teeth removed altogether. That sideways grin of the Dickensian street urchin was not the affliction of only a few sad, impoverished orphans. The upper classes suffered too. "The better the school, the worse the teeth," a Victorian dentist observed. Breathing problems skyrocketed. Back in the quarries, Red led me through the narrow opening of the ossuary, across rocks and bones and broken bottles. She told me how the cholera epidemic of the 1830s killed close to 20,000 people. The authorities had nowhere to put the dead, so they dug a big hole in Montparnasse Cemetery and buried them with quicklime to disintegrate the flesh. We were digging to the bottom of that hole. About 10 minutes later, we reached it, a room surrounded by piles of bones and skulls. I had expected this place to have a horror show creepiness, but it never materialized. Instead, entering there, surrounded by remnants of all these ancient lives, there was only a long and heavy stillness, like the sound of a rock dropped in a well after the echoes fade. Red and the cataphiles placed candles on the skulls and pulled cans of beer and groceries from their packs. I turned and wormed myself deeper into the chasm, pulling my body along the floor until it felt like my chest might be stuck between two huge boulders. At one point, I considered that if any of us might suddenly get trapped in here, if we were to break a leg or panic or lose our way, there was a good chance we'd never make it back out. Our skeletons would join the millions of others lining these walls, becoming candle holders for cataphiles in some future world. Onward and inward, another wiggle, another yank, and I was in the thick of it, hundreds and hundreds of skulls in all directions. These people had been city dwellers, and they'd likely relied on the same highly processed industrial foods. To my eye, their skulls all appeared to be lopsided, too short, their arches V-shaped and stunted in some way. I stayed for a while bathing in them, inspecting them, feeling them, and comparing them. Admittedly, I was very much a novice at inspecting skeletons, and perhaps some of these jaws and other pieces were mismatched. Nonetheless, there was such a clear difference in the shape and symmetry of these specimens compared to the dozens of hunter-gatherers and other populations I'd seen in books and websites before coming here. These were the patient zeros of the modern industrial mouth. "Voulez-vous manger quelque chose?" Red said, her words echoing off the bare walls. I shimmied back through the crawl space and joined the group. They were smoking, sharing swigs of arrak from a flask and passing around snacks in the flickering glow of candlelight. Red pulled off a chunk of soft white bread and a slice of plastic-wrapped cheese and handed it to me. Beneath the stare of all those age-old eye-holes, I took a bite and mashed it in my crooked mouth a couple times. Researchers have suspected that industrialized food was shrinking our mouths and destroying our breathing for as long as we've been eating this stuff. By the 1870s, several scientists hypothesized that the problems were linked to deficiencies in vitamin D. Without it, bones in the face, airways, and body couldn't develop. Others thought the lack of vitamin C was the culprit. In the 1930s, Weston Price, the founder of the National Dental Association Research Institute, decided it wasn't one specific vitamin or the other, but all of them. Price set out to prove his theory. But unlike his predecessors, he wasn't interested in the causes. He was interested in finding a cure. Ernest Houghton, a Harvard anthropologist who supported Price's work, said this: "Since we have known for a long time that savages have excellent teeth and that civilized men have terrible teeth, it seems to me that we have been extraordinarily stupid in concentrating all of our attention upon the task of finding out why our teeth are so poor without ever bothering to learn why the savages' teeth are good." Over the course of a decade, Price compared the teeth, airways, and general health of populations around the world. He examined indigenous communities whose members were still eating traditional foods. Then he compared them with other members in the same community, sometimes the same family, who had adopted a modern diet. He traveled to a dozen countries. He compiled more than 15,000 print photographs, 4,000 slides, thousands of dental records, and a library of detailed notes. The same story played out no matter where he went. Societies that replaced their traditional diet with modern processed foods suffered up to 10 times more cavities, severely crooked teeth, obstructed airways, and overall poorer health. The modern diets were the same: white flour, white rice, jam, sweetened juices, canned vegetables, and processed meats. The traditional diets were all different. In Alaska, Price found communities who ate seal meat, fish, lichen, and not much else. Deep inside Melanesian islands, he found tribes whose meals consisted of pumpkins, pawpaws, coconut crabs, and sometimes long pigs, also known as humans. He flew to Africa to study the nomadic Maasai, who subsisted mostly on cow's blood, some milk, a few plants, and a bite of steak. Then he traveled to central Canada and studied indigenous tribes who suffered through winters where the temperature could reach as low as 70 degrees below zero, and whose only food was wild animals. Some cultures ate nothing but meat, while others were mostly vegetarian. Some relied primarily on homemade cheese, while others consumed no dairy at all. Their teeth were almost always perfect. Their mouths were exceptionally wide, their nasal apertures broad. They suffered few, if any, cavities and little dental disease. Respiratory issues like asthma or even tuberculosis, Price reported, were practically non-existent. While the foods in these diets varied, they all contained the same high amounts of vitamins and minerals, from 1.5 to 50 times that of modern diets, all of them. Price became convinced that the cause of our shrinking mouths and obstructed airways was deficiencies not of just D or C, but of all these essential vitamins. These nutrients, after all, work in symbiosis. One needs the other to be effective. This explained why supplements could be useless unless they're in the presence of other supplements. We needed all these things to develop strong bones throughout the body, especially in the mouth and face. In 1939, Price published Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, a 500-page doorstop of data collected during his travels. It was a, quote, masterpiece of research, according to the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Ernest Houghton called it one of the, quote, epical pieces of research. But others hated the book and vehemently disagreed with Price's conclusions. It wasn't Price's facts and figures, or even his dietary advice, that made them bristle. Most of what he'd learned about the modern diet had already been verified by nutritionists years earlier. But some complained that Price overreached, that his observations were too anecdotal, his sample sizes too small. None of it really mattered. By the 1940s, the idea of spending hours a day preparing meals of fish eyes and moose glands, raw roots and cow blood, coconut crabs and pig kidneys, it all seemed outdated and quaint. It also was way too much work. Many people moved to cities to get away from those foods and the grimy lifestyle that came with them. Price, it turned out, was only half right. Yes, vitamin deficiencies might explain why so many people eating these industrial foods were sick. They might explain why so many were getting cavities and why their bones were growing thin and weak. But they couldn't explain the sudden and extreme shrinking of the mouth and blocking of the airways. Even if our ancestors consumed a full spectrum of vitamins and minerals every day, their mouths would still grow too small, their teeth would come in crooked, and their airways would become obstructed. This was as true for our ancestors as it is for us. The problem had less to do with what we were eating than how we ate it. Chewing. It was the constant stress of chewing that was lacking from our diets, not vitamins A, B, C, or D. 95% of the modern processed diet was soft. Even what's considered healthy food today, all those smoothies, nut butters, oatmeal, avocados, wheat bread, vegetable soups, and on, it's all soft. Our ancient ancestors chewed for hours a day, every day. And because they chewed so much, their mouths, teeth, throats, and faces grew to be wide and strong and pronounced. Food in industrialized societies was so processed that it hardly required any chewing at all. This is why so many of those skulls I'd examined in the Paris ossuary had narrow faces and crooked teeth. It's why so many of us snore today, why our noses are stuffed and our airways are clogged, why we need sprays, pills, or surgical drilling just to get a breath of fresh air. The cataphiles gathered their packs and bottles and cigarette butts from the ossuary, and I followed them through the crawl spaces, across the black streams, up the stone staircases, and out the secret door onto Rue Bonaparte. They scurried me past the police station and onto the metro, where a trail of human bone dust followed me like breadcrumbs from Victor Hugo Station back to a friend's apartment. I left Paris mildly haunted. Not by the piles of bones in those underground warrens, but by the comprehensiveness of our folly. What looked like human progress, all that milling, mass distribution, and preservation of food, it all had horrible consequences. Breathing slow, less, and exhaling deeply, I realized none of it would really matter unless we were able to get those breaths through our noses, down our throats, and into our lungs. But our caved-in faces and two small mouths had become obstacles to that clear path. I spent a few days feeling sorry for humanity and then quickly set off in search of solutions. There had to be procedures, manipulations, or something that could reverse the few centuries of damage from all that soft food. There had to be something that could help me with my own obstructive breathing. I started by visiting modern medical offices, meeting with specialists, who looked at the top of the nose and worked down from there. Dr. Nyack, the Stanford nose surgeon, told me during our earliest meeting that most of the nasal unblocking work he does involves turning a, quote, one-lane highway into a two-lane highway. If a sink is plugged, we find a way to clear it safely and rapidly. Sometimes we'll use Drano for a minor clog, but if that doesn't work, we'll call in a plumber. The nose tends to work in the same way. Sprays, rinses, and allergy medications can help quickly clear minor congestion, but for more serious problems, we'll need a surgeon to plumb it out. I heard this analogy a lot. Should I or anyone else develop a chronic nasal obstruction, Nyack first recommended a Drano approach in the form of a saline rinse. This treatment that costs next to nothing can be self-administered. He has also prescribed a topical rinse spiked with steroids for patients on the path to reconstructive nasal surgery and found that 5 to 10% no longer felt the need for further treatment. Should obstruction become more stubborn, Nyack might offer a patient a balloon. In this procedure, which sounds way more fun than it actually is, he inserts a small balloon into the sinuses and carefully inflates it. Balloon sinuplasty, as it's commonly called, creates more space for mucus and infection to pass out and air to pass in. In one unpublished case-control study, Nyack found that of the 28 selected sinusitis patients who received the procedure, 23 needed no other treatment. Sometimes the nostrils are the problem, not the sinuses. Nostrils that are too small or that collapse too easily during an inhale can inhibit the free flow of air. The condition is so common that researchers have an official name for it, nasal valve collapse. They also have an official measurement. It's called the Caudill's maneuver. It involves placing an index finger on the side of one or both nostrils and gently pulling outwards. If doing this improves the ease of nasal inhales, there's a chance the nostrils are too small or thin. Many people with this condition receive minimally invasive surgery or use BreatheRight strips or nasal dilator cones. If these simpler approaches fail, the drills come out. About 3/4 of modern humans have a deviated septum clearly visible to the naked eye, which means that the bone and the cartilage that separate the right and left airways of the nose are off-center. Along with that, 50% of us have chronically inflamed turbinates. The erectile tissue lining our sinuses is too puffed up for us to take a breath comfortably through our noses. Both problems can lead to chronic breathing difficulties and an increased risk of infection. Surgery is highly effective in straightening or reducing these structures, but NIAC warned it needs to be done carefully and conservatively. The nose, after all, is a wondrous ornate organ that works in a tightly controlled system. The vast majority of nasal surgeries are successful. Patients wake up, they take the splints out, and they're off. No more congestion, no more sinus headaches, no more mouth breathing. They are on their way to a new life, breathing better than they ever had before. But not all of them. If surgeons drill out too much of that tissue, especially in the turbinates, the nose can't effectively filter, humidify, or even sense inhaled air. For the small and unfortunate group of patients, each breath comes in too quickly, a hideous condition called empty nose syndrome. I interviewed several empty nose sufferers seeking to understand their condition. I talked for months with Peter, a laser technician from Seattle. He'd scheduled a surgery hoping to clear up some minor obstruction and, against his permission, had 75% of his turbinates removed over 2 procedures. Within days of the first, he felt a sense of suffocation. He couldn't sleep. The surgeons convinced Peter that they hadn't removed enough, so he went back in. The second surgery made things even worse. Years later, each breath Peter took shot a bolt of pain to his brain, as if it had been delivered from an air pump. Doctors told Peter nothing was wrong. They gave him antidepressants, or they suggested regular exercise. At one point, he contemplated suicide. I traveled to Latvia to meet for 2 days with the then president of the Empty Nose Syndrome Association. Her name was Ala, and she was in her early 30s. She was physically fit and had never suffered from any serious illness. About 8 years ago, during a checkup, a doctor found a small cyst in her sinus and suggested Ala have it removed in a routine procedure. The surgeon dug through her nose, removing large portions of her sinuses and turbinates while forgetting to remove the cyst. The effects were dramatic. "It feels like I'm constantly drowning in air," Ala told me. She was forced to quit her career and give up most of her physical activity. "Every day is a struggle, every breath." Hundreds of people with empty nose syndrome told me overlapping stories. They complained about sleepless nights, panic attacks, anxiety, loss of appetite, and chronic depression. The more they breathed, the more out of breath they felt. Their doctors, families, and friends couldn't understand. Having access to more air more quickly could only be an advantage, they said. But we now know the opposite is true. 10% of NIAC's patients in the past 6 years, nearly 150 people from 25 states and 7 countries, have come to Stanford to reverse their surgeries. If they pass a rigorous screening test, NIAC will go into their noses and add back the soft tissues and cartilage that had been taken out. One estimate says that up to 20% of patients who got their lower turbinates removed were at risk of eventually suffering some degree of empty nose syndrome. The number of patients complaining of breathing difficulties after more minor procedures is certainly far lower, but even if they represented 1% of 1%, the empty nose stories spooked me enough to explore other options before I ever went under the knife to fix my own obstructed breathing. So I dug a little deeper, a little lower, into the mouth. Sleep apnea and snoring, asthma, and ADHD are all linked to obstruction in the mouth. There are no professionals who spend more time looking in the mouth than dentists. I talked to half a dozen of them who specialize in procedures to remove these obstacles. Here is what they look for. If you go to a mirror right now and open your mouth, you'll see a fleshy tassel that hangs bat-like above the throat. That's the uvula. In mouths least susceptible to airway obstruction, the uvula will appear high and clearly visible from top to bottom. The deeper the uvula appears to hang in the throat, the higher the risk of airway obstruction. In mouths that are most susceptible, the uvula may not be visible at all. Next is the tongue. If the tongue overlaps the molars or has teeth indentations on its sides, it's too large and will be more apt to clog the throat when you lie down to sleep. Further down is the neck. Thicker necks cramp airways. Men with neck circumferences of more than 17 inches and women with necks larger than 16 inches will have a significantly increased risk of airway obstruction. The more weight you gain, the higher your risk of suffering from snoring and sleep apnea. But body mass is only one of many factors. Weightlifters frequently deal with sleep apnea and chronic breathing problems, but instead of layers of fat, they have muscles crowding their airways. Plenty of rail-thin distance runners and even infants suffer too. That's because the blockage doesn't start in the neck, the uvula, or the tongue. It starts with the mouth, and mouth size is indiscriminate. There are various ways to fix this. Dr. Michael Gelb is a renowned New York dentist who specializes in treating snoring, sleep apnea, anxiety, and other breathing-related problems. "I see her, the same patient, every day," he told me when I first visited his Madison Avenue clinic. Many of Gelb's patients don't fit the traditional mold. They are in their mid-30s, fit, successful. No health issues growing up, but in the last couple years, they'd experienced fatigue, bowel issues, and headaches. Their ears hurt when they bite down. Their primary care doctors misdiagnose them and prescribe antidepressants, but the drugs don't work. So they try a continuous positive airway pressure mask, or a CPAP, which forces bursts of air past the obstructed airways into the lungs. CPAPs are a lifesaver for those suffering from moderate to severe sleep apnea, and the devices have helped millions of people finally get a good night's rest. But Gelb told me that his patients have a hard time wearing them. Further, many don't have diagnosed sleep apnea. Yet these people keep getting more tired, more forgetful, and sicker. They may not be registering an apnea problem, Gelb told me, but they all had serious breathing problems. "By the time I get them, I'm dealing with the walking dead," he said. Gelb and his colleagues sometimes remove tonsils and adenoids. This can be especially effective for children. 50% of kids with ADHD were shown to no longer have symptoms after just having their adenoids and tonsils removed. But these effects can also be fleeting. Years after surgery, children can develop obstructions in the airways and all the problems that come with it. That's because neither adenoid or tonsil removal, nor CPAP, nor other procedures provide a long-term solution. None deals with the core issue, a mouth that is too small for the face. The earliest orthodontics devices weren't designed to straighten teeth, but to widen the mouth and open airways. In the 1800s, a host of children were born with cleft palates and narrow V-shaped arches. Their mouths were so small that they had trouble eating, speaking, and breathing. Norman Kingsley, a dentist and sculptor, wanted to help them. So in 1859, he built a device that forced the jaw forward, creating more room at the back of the mouth to open the throat. worked well enough that by the 1900s, a French surgeon named Pierre Robin was designing his own contraption. Robin called it a monoblock, and it consisted of a plastic retainer with a dowel screw that forced the upper palate to grow outward. Within a few weeks, his patients' mouths grew larger and their breathing was significantly improved. The monoblock kicked off a wave of other mouth-expanding devices that would be used for another benefit, straightening crooked teeth. Teeth will always grow in naturally straight if they have enough room. Expanding devices return the mouth to the width it was intended to be, offering a larger playing field. Expansion would remain standard dental practice for the next 20 years and would continue to be used throughout Europe for decades after that. But the process of expanding a mouth took expertise and maintenance. Results varied depending on the skill of the dentist. It didn't help that these devices were miserable and awkward to wear. For patients with overbites, the most common problem in the mouth, few dentists could figure out how to move the bottom jaw forward, so they began working on ways to just move the top of the mouth back. By the 1940s, it became standard practice for dentists to extract teeth, then wrench the top teeth back with headgear and braces. Fewer teeth were easier to handle and offered more consistent results. By the 50s, tooth extractions, 2, 4, even 6 at a time, were routine. There was a glaring problem with this approach. Removing teeth and pushing remaining teeth backward only made a too small mouth smaller. This might be easier for dentists to manage, but it also offered less room to breathe. A few months or years after treatment, some patients would complain about snoring or sleep apnea, hay fever, and asthma that they never had before. When they bit down, they noticed a clicking sound at the back of their jaws, along the temporomandibular joint. Some began to look different, too, their faces growing longer and flatter. These patients might have represented only a small percentage, but enough showed the same problems that in the late 1950s, a former biplane pilot, semi-professional Formula One driver, and British dentist named John Mew took notice. Dr. Mew began measuring the faces and mouths of young patients who'd gotten extractions and compared them with patients who'd gotten expansion treatment. Brothers and sisters measured against their siblings, even sets of identical twins. Over and over again, the children who'd had teeth removed and undergone retractive orthodontics suffered from the same stunted growth. As they grew up, the rest of their bodies and heads grew larger, but their mouths were forced to stay the same size. This mismatch created a problem at the center of their face. Eyes would droop, cheeks would puff up, and chins would recess. The more teeth these patients had extracted, the longer they wore braces and other devices, the more obstruction seemed to develop in their airways. Mew called this pattern, quote, sadly a common sequel to fixed orthodontic treatment. In a strange twist, he found that the devices invented to fix crooked teeth caused by too small mouths were actually making mouths smaller and breathing worse. Mew wasn't alone. Several other dentists had come to the same conclusions, publishing scientific papers on the subject. Mew would conduct his own studies, taking hundreds of measurements and before and after photos of his patients. He even conducted biochemical analysis of the cell structure of the lips, all of which he claimed clearly proved how the combination of extractions and fixed orthodontics hindered forward facial growth and breathing. He'd serve as president of the Southern Counties branch of the British Dental Association and would use his influence to petition administrators to run a full investigation. But nobody did anything. Nobody really cared. Instead, Mew would become one of the most divisive men in dentistry, ridiculed as a quack, a scammer, and a snake oil salesman. He was sued repeatedly to stop practicing expansion and would eventually lose his license. As he approached the 10th decade of his life, it appeared that Mew was going to follow the same trajectory as Stow, Price, and so many other pulmonauts, to die in obscurity, buried along with his research. but something curious has happened in the past few years. Hundreds of leading orthodontists and dentists have come out in support of Mu's position, saying that yes, traditional orthodontics really were making breathing worse in their patients. The strongest endorsement came in April 2018 when Stanford University Press published a 216-page monograph by famed evolutionary biologists Paul R. Ehrlich and Dr. Sandra Kahn. They detailed hundreds of scientific references that supported Mu's research. In a short time, Mu's outlier theories started entering the mainstream. "In 10 years, nobody will be using traditional orthodontics," Gelb had told me. "We'll look back at what we've done and be horrified." The rebellion within eventually led to the formation of a professional organization with an awfully clumsy name: the Academy of Orofacial Myofunctional Therapy. This group, I'd learned, was much more interested in fixing the problem of undersized mouths than blaming those who contributed to it. There were too many variables, too many guilty parties, they said. As with so many other fixes that I'd come across before, Mu and the others discovered that the tools they needed to remove airway obstruction, to restore the function in that too small mouth, were created long ago by observant scientists whose research was accepted as the standard, and then, for one reason or another, forgotten. I visited John Mu 2 weeks after my expedition into the Paris quarries, arrived at an empty train station in East Sussex, and an hour later was in the passenger seat of a Renault minivan. Mu was at the wheel, driving twice the speed limit down a country road. "I've come under incredible resistance the whole way," he told me. "But the science is clear, the facts are clear, the evidence is everywhere. There's really no way they can keep stopping it now." It was Sunday afternoon, and Mu's only plans were to meet with me and have his children over for tea, but he dressed in a three-piece suit with a white shirt and a rep tie from his preparatory school, which he had attended 75 years ago. We veered onto a gravel driveway and over a small bridge, then parked in the shadow of a stone turret. I'd heard that Mu lived in a castle, but was expecting something more castle-esque, the kind of thing with painted concrete and vinyl siding. But every detail of this place looked strikingly real, from the mossy roof to the black water moat. Mu killed the motor, grabbed his cane, and led me through dark hallways to a kitchen of blackwood cabinets and copper pots. For several hours we sat beside a roaring hearth, where I heard about how Mu had built this castle, doing much of the work himself when he was in his late 70s. I also heard how Mu's various devices were used to expand mouths. His most renowned invention was the BioBlock, a modified version of Pierre Robin's monoblock. Mu used it on hundreds of his own patients. Hundreds of orthodontists still use it today. A 2006 peer-reviewed study of 50 children showed that the BioBlock expanded airways by up to 30% over the course of half a year. I came here because I'd become interested in expanding my own too small mouth and opening my own too small airways. But Mu told me his device works best for children aged around 5 to 9 years, whose bones and faces were still developing and easily moldable. For me, that was several lifetimes ago. Mu's son, Mike, who was also a dentist, joined the conversation. He was tanned, tall, and lanky, with piercing brown eyes and dressed in fashion jeans and a tight-fitting sweater. He explained that the first step to improving airway obstruction wasn't orthodontics, but instead involved maintaining correct oral posture. Anyone could do this, and it was free. It just meant holding the lips together, teeth lightly touching, with your tongue on the roof of the mouth. When sitting or standing, the spine should form a J shape, perfectly straight until it reaches the small of the back, where it naturally curves outward. While maintaining this posture, we should always breathe slowly and through the nose into the abdomen. Look at any Greek statue or drawing by Leonardo or an ancient portrait. Everyone shared this J shape. But if we look around public spaces today, most people have shoulders hunched forward, necks extended outward, and an S-shaped spine.
A bunch of village idiots! That's what we become, shouted Mike.
He then assumed this idiot position, inhaling a few short, puffy, and open-mouthed breaths, and looked around dumbly.
It's bloody killing us!
Most of us adopted this S-shaped posture, Mike said, not because of laziness, but because our tongues don't fit properly in our two small mouths. Having nowhere else to go, the tongue falls back into the throat, creating a mild suffocation. At night, we choke and cough, attempting to push air in and out through the obstructed airway. This, of course, is sleep apnea. By day, we attempt to open our airways by sloping our shoulders, craning our necks forward, and tilting our heads up.
Think of someone who is unconscious and about to receive CPR, Mike said.
The first thing a medic does is tilt the head back to open the throat. We've adopted the CPR posture all the time. Our bodies hate this position. The weight of the sloping head stresses the back muscles, leading to back pain. The kink in our neck adds pressure to the brainstem, triggering headaches. Because the village idiot stare doesn't sound scientific, Mike calls the posture cranial dystrophy. He claims it affects about 50% of the modern population, including Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook. In January 2018, Mike uploaded a YouTube video warning Zuckerberg that he was going to die 10 years early if he didn't correct his poor cranial dystrophy. The message was viewed more than 9,000 times before it was deleted. Along with maintaining this oral posture, Mike recommended a series of tongue-thrusting exercises, which he says can train us out of this death pose and make breathing a lot easier. The exercise, which Mike's hordes of social media fans called mewing, has been popularly adopted as a new health craze. After a few months, mewers have claimed their mouths expanded, jaws became more defined, sleep apnea symptoms lessened, and breathing became easier. Mike's own instructional video has been viewed more than 1 million times. It's difficult to convey how to mew without seeing it, but the gist is to push the back of the tongue against the back roof of the mouth and move the rest of the tongue forward like a wave until just the tip hits just behind the front teeth. I tried it a few times. It felt awkward, like I was holding back vomit.